I'm Anita Hill, and this is the last of a series of 2 weeks dealing with issues of homosexuality, gay and lesbian people, ministry in that context, and this week more specifically looking at homophobia. And today's session is strategies for change, strategies for eliminating homophobia or lessening or changing it. And I guess the first couple things I'd say about it, the two things that I would lift up that I feel are most important about changing the milieu in which we experience life as gay and lesbian people is first to break the silence about it, to begin to talk about it. And we've, you know, started some of that here. All of us leave from here and go to separate places and communities and congregations and other settings. But to try to set the context in which you can take the risks to begin talking about it, to hear each other out, to disagree if you have disagreements about it, to study together, to learn together and struggle together. The silence, they say, is the language of abuse, whatever the particular topic. And I think that also seems to be the case around issues of gay and lesbian people in their lives, that it is the silences that begin to be the killer about it. And the other thing that's equally as important is to make sure that the voices of gay and lesbian people are heard in your midst, wherever those places are where you study and learn and struggle. Having trouble hearing? These little gizzies work real well. Let me hand you one of these. You put this part in your ear. Anybody else want to try one of these too? I'll clip on this one. It's like a little homegrown radio system here.
There's another one.
Would you like one also? I think there's probably more in Tate Ministry if anybody else wants to try one too. And a reminder for me to speak up a bit as well. All right, is that helping? Can you get that now? Okay. Well, secondly, I was starting to say that a key thing that is important to people understanding each other as people is that you hear the voices or the stories of gay and lesbian people. That I think probably the most helpful and effective thing that can happen around this topic for us in the church is for people who are gay or lesbian Christians to have opportunity to dialogue with others. I'm still struck by, in 1990, how many people I meet who say, I've never talked with a person who's identified themselves openly as gay or lesbian and also part of the church, or even gay or lesbian at all, had any conversation with them. I see pictures sometimes, or I read some things from the press, but I don't have opportunity to talk or to hear their stories or ask the questions. Well, talking about it, you know, as I said, is the ways to take it out of here, out of Holden Village, back to some other places. The other thing is to begin to combat the kinds of stereotypes that you hear. If you're in your workplace and you hear somebody joking about gay and lesbian people, then now you have to think about what your response is going to be. Are you going to say nothing? Something, you know, if you hear it at home, you hear it from teenagers at the school where you work, or if you're a student, you hear it from your peers in those settings. What kind of response do you have? We'll play through some of that in a little bit. And I have a list of things put together by a couple of women in the Twin Cities, Diane Benjamin and Patty Christensen, called What Is It Like to Be Gay or Lesbian? And it's a series of ideas about things that you can try to find out about some of those experiences. It says to pick up a copy of the gay lesbian newspaper in your locale. Of course, that would mean you have to do some researching to figure out, is there such a thing? Where is it found? You know, that sort of stuff. It suggests that you read it, that you spend a day carrying it around with you. You know, and then what do you do with it? You know, do you hide it when you see people coming that you know? Do you take it with you to work or out to lunch? If you sit and read it openly if you're sitting on a plane that day flying somewhere? Those are the sorts of things, the questions that I have to deal with too, about, you know, what am I going to have to deal with if indeed I am reading the gay newspaper sitting in the plane on the way home tomorrow as I fly? What are the responses of others around me going to be? But just in doing each of these exercises, you might try to feel the feelings of that experience. What is it like to do this, and what, you know, kinds of responses do I have? Secondly, the suggestion is that you attend a meeting of PFLAG. PFLAG, Parents and Friends of Lesbians and Gays, is an organization that has chapters across the country, has offices in Denver, Colorado, and in Washington, D.C., and it's parents and siblings and other people who are friends of lesbian and gay folks who gather for support, to have educational gatherings together, to spend some time in a safe place talking about their gay or lesbian person, their family member. We have such a group that meets at the congregation where I'm staff back in St. Paul, and it draws people from across much of the southern part of the state of Minnesota. And they've had the experience there of two families driving in from the same small town, unbeknownst to each other, to come to this meeting and end up then finding out that there are others in my small town. Even an instance of two families from the same congregation, both of whom felt like their congregation was not a place where they could say this out loud. And it may be around the issue of gay and lesbian folks. It may be around the issue of AIDS and somebody whose son is coming home to die with AIDS. To try to live a life with AIDS. And that may be the entree for a community to find out about somebody who's gay or lesbian. So next example suggests that you call up a church and ask if they're open to lesbian and gay men being involved in their congregation. You know, just sort of a telephone inquiry. I'm new in town. I'm looking for a congregation. You can, you know, weave the story however you'd like. I'm gay myself, you might say. See what that feels like in the midst of the phone conversation to gather info. Or say my son or daughter is, and I'm looking for a place where they would be welcome when they come. Ask them, do they have any programs aimed specifically at this group of people, or are there any openly gay people in their congregation? Could ask the questions in person on Sunday morning rather than doing it in a telephone call. Sort of ups the ante one step further to try that. Suggest that you go to a gay or lesbian bookstore or library and there to look through the kinds of materials that are there. There is a whole gay lesbian culture of sorts. What are the things that make up culture? Language, art, music, books, fiction. What are the things that make gay and lesbian people laugh? You know, where's the humor in it? Other sorts of things. I had some suggestions of several fiction books that in particular the women's groups at my own church about these issues. Some of them said, well, I don't want to particularly read all that heavy sort of stuff exploring about this. I'd like to find out, you know, aren't there any novels I could read? So several I would offer up to you. A couple of them about women. One is called Ruby Fruit Jungle, written by Rita Mae Brown. Another, Patience and Sarah, and the author of that one is escaping me. A couple about men. One is called The Front Runner, written by Patricia Nell Warren. And another, The Best Little Boy in the World. I think it's John Little. I'm not certain of the name on that one. But to begin to review some of those sorts of materials might be ways to get on the inside of the experience of being gay or lesbian person without actually being one yourself. Call up a social service agency or a hotline. Ask what services are available for gay and lesbian people in your community. A pretty simple one to do is suggesting that you walk in public for a while, a couple blocks down the street, with someone of the same sex and hold their hand. Notice other people's reactions to you. Notice your own reactions about, you know, are you more acutely aware of other people around you or not in doing that exercise. Another thing that you could do would be to attend a worship service at a predominantly gay or lesbian church. There are a number of them. Places to do that within our own Lutheran setting would be to find the local chapter of Lutherans Concerned. Lutherans Concerned North America is an organization that has chapters across this country and in Canada. And it is a group of gay and lesbian people and also non-gay supporters, friends, working for Christian understanding within the Lutheran Church. And I want to give you the address of Lutherans Concerned. Its main office is in Chicago. And perhaps some of you might want to, maybe there are people here who are members of Lutherans Concerned. Some that I've talked with this week are familiar with it. I'll just put up LCNA. It's Post Office Box 10461, Fort Dearborn Station. In Chicago, 60610. It's important that people also who are not gay are part of Lutherans Concerned. Why do you think that might be? Anybody?
Might be the people who would be part of the PFLAG.
People who are part of PFLAG would be part of that. The other is that it, in some sense, provides a place of safety for somebody who is gay or lesbian who might be concerned that somebody find out I'm in Lutherans Concerned and then make the quick assumption I'm gay or lesbian. So part of it would be to help protect those who are. Part of it is to heighten your own awareness. There's a newsletter that comes out several times a year from Lutherans Concerned. Would be a place to learn and know about it. We happen to be blessed with the presence of Lynn Mickelson this morning, who's the president just elected of Lutherans Concerned at the National Assembly last month. You want to add anything, Lynn, about LC, how you see it?
No, not really. It's a really wonderful organization, and if you write to us, and it's one that I'm quite proud of, and I was surprised at our last assembly at how many non-gay and lesbian people were there, and that was really neat, too. If you write to us, we'll probably send you the usual brochures, but also a copy of Concord, which will give you a list of all the chapters throughout the United States and Canada.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, the idea behind all of these activities is that for a short time, you know, you're in charge of the experience, but you're assumed to be gay or lesbian. And then in the processing your own feelings about that, it gives you much more of an idea about what it is like to be a gay or lesbian person. Announcing in either subtle or overt ways that you're not gay somehow defeats the process. So for that brief time, let me encourage you to try that. These are things that gay and lesbian people confront on a day-to-day basis, and things that many who are non-gay don't often think about at all. So it's a way for you to sort of put the shoes on of the other for a bit and do that. I've got a number of pages. Let me pass these around. Just those of you who feel like reading something out loud, take one of them. It's an exercise called a read-around, and it's a number of clips that I've taken out of newspapers, some of them gay and lesbian sources, others not, news media. This would be a way to open up the experience to others. When you have that, take a moment and read it, those of you who've gotten it, and then I'll ask you to go around and just to read it out loud.
I'd like to just jump in and, if I could, and share that I've had the chance to try some of those exercises.
Yes, oh, please.
And very powerful. And it's just the amount of shame that came up, and real fear, like you come around the corner of the grocery store and you just be mobbed by people. I mean, really irrational kinds of things that come up. I think it's real powerful to presume that role of being gay or lesbian for a while and act that out. I was just really surprised, having participated in some meetings of Lutherans Concerned and other things already. And then, so presuming that I was already kind of up on the topic and knew the biblical stuff and some of his arguments, that I was already, in tune. It wasn't like I didn't have a clue.
About what the feelings were like.
Yeah.
Talked with a number of people who say that before they came out, they were much more comfortable women in particular, much more comfortable with their women friends giving them a hug or greeting them with a kiss or holding their hand or, you know. And I know for me, there was a, when I was in the workplace at the University of Michigan Hospital, shared an office with another secretary there, and she, during this year that we worked together, went through a pregnancy. She had trouble with swollen feet and, you know, shoulders ached, and I would rub her back and that sort of thing. And after I came out to her, then I was scared to death that she was going to misread all those sorts of things, or that once anybody knew about me, everything that I did then they assumed to be some sort of sexual overlay. So I had to wrestle through that myself about, you know, what was, you know, was that my own lens, or was that really the lens of other people? And there is sort of a process, I think, that one goes through in coming out where you feel like everything is sort of funneled through every reaction that I'm getting. If I'm in the grocery store squeezing cantaloupes, somebody's going to think the wrong thing of me. You know? It's as though I think somehow that there's a sign hung all over me and everybody can tell just by looking at me that I am lesbian. And that's not the case either. Sometimes the funneling happens in families when somebody comes out, or that the gay or lesbian person, whenever they're challenged about anything within the family system, says, well, you're just picking on me because I'm gay. And there comes a time when that just can't cut any ice either. I mean, that person may not be making their bed in the morning, taking care of their part of the duties at home, may not be holding up their end of the communication link that's so necessary within a family. And those are other issues of behavior and personality that aren't particularly gay or lesbian things. So to remember that that's part of it too, and not to funnel everything through that. Just because you're talking with a gay person, everything they talk about isn't a gay thing necessarily. You have your hand
then,
up too.
Then I wonder, is there an advantage to coming out? Like I'm a single person, and maybe people look at me and wonder whether I'm sexually active, and I'm not going to tell them if
right.
I am or am not. It's kind of like that.
Yeah, it's different than just being sexually active. Being gay or lesbian is much more than that.
Yeah.
And for me, in part, it is, you know, that question about, well, why do gay people want to come out? Why do they want someone to know? Is that it's an important part of who I am. If indeed I am in a significant relationship with someone else, I don't want everyone assuming that I am a single person all the time. People may assume with your... you know, they may assume that you're not single. With me, everybody assumes that I am, including IRS, my church, every place else,
mm-hmm.
assumes that I am, unless there's, you know, some other speaking of that. And people say, well, we don't have to go around saying that we're heterosexual. No, well, most of the world is, for starters. We wear wedding rings. We, you know, people arrive here, husband and wife and children are housed in the same space. Assumptions are made about family situation and about relationships that don't get made for gay and lesbian people unless we are intentional about naming who we are. Well, now that you had a chance to look at those sheets that I've handed out, why don't you just read them out loud and we'll talk about the hearing of them.
A district court judge told a reporter he gave a convicted murderer a lenient sentence because his victims were gay. Was publicly censured November 28th by the Texas State Commission on Judicial Conduct. In issuing this censure, the commission took the strongest action possible short of removing the judge, Jack Hampton, from the bench. Gay Community News, January 1990.
Someone else?
After weeks of politically wrangling and intense debate, the San Francisco Board of Education approved a controversial plan on June 12 to provide school-sponsored counseling and support services for gay and lesbian youth. The program will focus on self-identified gay, lesbian, or bisexual youth. It is intended to promote safe school and prevent verbal and physical harassment and discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. San Francisco Chronicle reported in Equal Time, July 1990.
Those who watched last summer's tennis championships at Wimbledon may have noticed something new. While cameras routinely panned to the boyfriends and husbands of the female tennis stars, they did not neglect Martina Navratilova's off-court partner, Judy Benson, who was regularly seen reacting to Martina's plays on television. Lesbian Connection, January 1988.
Superman won't play gay. A 10-year-old screenplay for a movie 2018 continues to have problems with casting for lead roles. The film has been shuffled from producer to producer. It has been rewritten several times. According to the Weekly News, the director of The Front Runner offered $1 million to Christopher Reeves to play a gay track coach. The former Superman turned down the offer, apparently because he played gay once before in a film version of Death Trap and is worried about his image. Gay Community News, Boston, February 28, 1988.
This is from the Philadelphia Gay News, October of 1987. John Silver, president of Boston University, claimed that anti-gay violence is not an issue on campus because there are no gay or lesbian students.
Washington Blade reported the lesbian connection January 1988. In Stockholm, the Swedish parliament has passed two laws concerning gay rights. An anti-discrimination law makes it illegal for commercial establishments to refuse services to gays for property owners to refuse to sign contracts because of sexual orientation. The other law gives gay couples living together the same rights as common law heterosexual partners. In Sweden, unmarried sexual couples can file joint tax returns, inherit property from a partner in absence of a will, and sign leases as couples.
This is from the Lesbian Connection, July 1988. The Boulder County, Colorado Department of Social Services approved an application by a lesbian living with another woman to adopt a child. An administrator for the social service agency said the woman's bid was considered a single parent adoption. The administrator said, "We look at individuals regardless of their sexual preference."
Gay actor Michael Booth was beaten to death near West London Park in the early morning, in the early hours of April 30th, 1990. In an attached described by one of the doctors as the most horrific I had ever seen. Police are appealing for help in solving what they believe was a queer bashing record. Capital K reported in full time.
Gay men in Los Angeles are being held blackmailed by a group identifying itself as a community control group of the Lord's Order. The group threatens exposure of these men to employers, friends, and family members unless they pay the group $3,000 in the Baltimore Alternative, October 1987.
A student who supported the production of Larry Kramer's The Normal Heart at Southwest Missouri State University had his house burned to the ground on the play's opening night. Arson is suspected. Brad Evans, a theater student, was at AIDS vigil when the fire occurred. A local group called Citizens Demanding Standards had denounced the production, claiming it uses state funds for the promotion of the homosexual political agenda. Evans had formed an organization to defend the production. Dare reported at Equal Time, January 1990.
Okay, are there others?
Quote of the week. Another point of light just went out, President Bush. Excerpt from the obituary of Perry L. Norman of San Francisco, who died of AIDS last month, at Equal Time, January 1990.
The three largest national news magazines, Time, Newsweek, and U.S. News and World Report, totally ignored the March on Washington, despite the fact that it was one of the largest civil rights demonstrations in our nation's history. 600,000 plus demonstrators. That was from the Lesbian Connection, January 1988.
Here's another from the Lesbian Connection. In Providence, Rhode Island, a family court judge has placed restrictions on a divorced woman's custody of her 12-year-old daughter because the mother is a lesbian. The court ruled that the mother must not have a living homosexual lover, must not expose the child to any homosexual activity, and cannot bring the child into contact with anyone the mother has a homosexual relationship with.
What kind of responses do you have to hearing these read?
Anger.
Anger?
Some of them are hopeful.
Some were hopeful. responses to any specifics that you heard?
This one here about the university in Boston, I think that was an 87 date. Mm-hmm. I think I sort of react in disbelief. What was the date again?
October 87.
87, yeah.
I was with a group of gay students at Concordia in Moorhead, Minnesota, who had gone to the president there in their bid to try to have a gay support group on campus, and who had the president tell them at that point, this is my repeating of the story, and I realize it's on tape, so I'll probably be held responsible for it, but that even as these gay students were sitting in his office coming out to him, said, we don't have gay students at Concordia. As if, you know, certainly we couldn't have a support group keep this very quiet. But it's kind of surprising to me, too, that somebody would say that still in 87. That's why there's no comments. Other responses from anyone?
I think that's one of the reasons people should come out. I mean, I always struggle with why gays come out. Why should they come out? Well, one of the reasons they have to come out is so that we all learn that person sitting next to us is gay and that they're a wonderful, warm person, and you can't just go say that those gays on TV are the only gays there are. Yeah. That person sitting next to you is gay, and you ought to know that. You ought to know that that's a warm, wonderful person. Yeah.
10% of the population are gay and lesbian. How many people are there in our new ELCA? Something on the order of 5 million people? So that's 10% of that. It's a lot of people. So if you begin to think about it, and just narrowing the focus to that 10% of the people, I think, does not begin to open the door to what we need to explore within the church, because that doesn't include their parents or their siblings or spouses or children or others who are affected by this, and that conspiracy of silence not to talk about it impacts all of those folks. I've been wearing a button around here this week that says, 1 in 10 of you, maybe one of us. Because I don't know either who the 10% are out there in this village or in Wenatchee when I hit it this afternoon or in Seattle when I get there later. That, you know, there's not any way for us to know who the other is either. You know, those of us who are gay or lesbian, unless we meet someone in a gay or lesbian place or they've identified themselves to us in some other way.
Yeah. You know that there are some settings where you are safer to be, and so you might seek those out.
Exactly.
The village would be much more open to you being welcome and to you being safe to identify yourself.
Yeah, that Holden.
And so the percentage here at Holden is going to be higher.
And, of those who are out.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Other comments about the read around?
In reference to the comment about the San Francisco School District along Canson for gays and lesbians, do you have any statistics on what percentage of teen suicides are related to kids that can deal with their sexuality?
1 out of 3. Mm-hmm. 30% of teen suicide has to do with difficulties around orientation issues. Mm-hmm. And that's really a sad figure. Mm-hmm. To know.
It just struck me how the one reading about the president of Boston and President Concordia, that I would be very, I know that the majority of people in our church and all our churches would say the same thing about our congregations. Do we have gay and lesbian people in our congregation? Oh no, they're not in our congregation. They're someplace else, or they're not here, they're not in this room, they're not in this place. So it's, we all laughed, I think, but.
Yeah, some of the reframing of the question around that, sometimes when I have clergy in particular tell me that, no, I don't have any gay people in my congregation, is to say that you baptized 10% of them along the way. How did you lose this 10% of your flock? You know, and begin to pose the question in some other ways. For us in the church to frame the questions in trying to determine, you know, what is the role of gay and lesbian people in our midst? Why are they here? Why are they in the midst of a family? The kinds of learnings that people experience as they go through the kinds of exercises you spoke about or others or have a gay or lesbian family member. Had a young fellow here whose volunteer staff speak very eloquently about finding out that his aunt was gay, someone he had really looked up to, and the sorting and learning that he did from finding out that. I know that there must be people in my own family history that I don't know about, that the family just has not talked about. It's a little cartoon about this young fellow at his bedside kneeling, saying his prayers at night, and the parents are overhearing him from the doorway saying, "And God bless Uncle Jack and his roommate Harry, whom we're not supposed to talk about." But there is that piece of everyone in the family knowing that someone's there, but they don't get talked about. You know, the person, the extra who comes along to the family events at Thanksgiving or Christmas that sort of gets introduced maybe as somebody's roommate or something, but never really asked about or supported about. Some of it might be to ask them, how do we begin to remove the onus for asking somebody if they're gay or lesbian? To not be so fearful, if I ask you if you are and you're not, that you're either going to hate me for the rest of my life or I'm going to be decked on the spot for having asked the question even, is to begin to change the mode of homophobia about it. It's sort of like, well, why have you picked that up? You know, what is it? And yet I think maybe kids do, and maybe parents do, pick up something that's different about the 10% who are. I talked with lots of parents, my own mother, for example, telling me that I knew something was different about you when you were very small. She somehow chalked it off to my being independent and rebellious. It was the language she used. Very different than my own thinking about my childhood, in which I made straight A's and did extracurricular activities and saw myself doing the best little girl in the world routine. She saw me as a reason to be concerned because I wasn't crazy over boys the way my older sister was. And here I thought I was doing my parents a favor because I didn't stay out till 2 a.m. and come home with some young man, you know? At that point, I was not even aware myself about being gay, but she knew that something was different there. My own experience, I don't see myself particularly as an unattractive person, and yet I was not asked to go out in high school, and that was a time period at which the boys still did the asking in the late 60s. Is it that we read something about each other that never comes to consciousness for us? Do we know something about those who are gay or lesbian? Certainly there are the stereotypical sorts of cues that we can pick up on, but there are people that don't fit the stereotypes too. I mean, I know homecoming queens who were lesbian, you know, the major captain of the football team as well, who was gay. And those don't fit our stereotypes of who we think gay and lesbian people are, but they're there.
Are anyway. You suggesting that it would be nice if we could get to a more comfortable place being able to ask somebody if
yes.
they're gay or lesbian? And would you feel offended if somebody just, I mean, what's your usual response? Or is that something we have to also...
Well, at this change? Point in time, it's sort of like, do I know this person? And I want to know why they want to know. Mm-hmm. You know, if it's somebody on the street asking me that, you know, I could... First, I'm trying to figure out my own safety level. Am I safe to say this? You know, depends on how it's asked. If it's asked in a respectful, caring way, or are you really a lesbo? Kind of stuff. You know, I've been walking down the street before. I live in a very mixed racial neighborhood in St. Paul and had a bunch of teenagers, mixed race, hollering at me, "Are you a faggot?" as I walk down the street. Well, it's like they have some learning to do because the word faggot implies maleness and I'm not male. But so I could easily say to them no and keep going. it was a shaking kind of experience.
They were just doing that randomly though. They were saying that to anybody they saw.
I don't know. And see, my own reading of that, is that what you'd assume if they said it to you?
I would assume that. Because, you know, kids will do that.
Part of what it says to me is, you know, am I wearing a target somehow that people are picking this out about me, you know, around
the next... probably just going down the street then, and when they hit you, you reacted differently.
Mm-hmm. Could be.
Except, though, that tells us a lot about our society. That's an issue of fear where teenagers can get you, can hook you. And whether that's me or anybody else, it's still very pervasive, but that's an issue where you can be threatened, like, why are you asking? Or
isn't it stronger for the individual to be able to look at someone and say, well, see, I don't know if this good person is homosexual or heterosexual, but I really don't care. And person is a person, and I just assume know this person. And maybe it's safer for me not to know, because then I can relate to you as an individual rather than according to your sexual preference. Aren't you actually, in some ways, hurting a movement by forcing people to ask about your sexual preference?
No, I'm not suggesting that people be forced to ask about it or forced to listen to it either, but in the building of friendships and relationships, there comes a point in which people do begin to share with each other. Think about the workplace and Monday morning coffee hour when you share with each other what you did over the weekend. There may be somebody in your workplace who seems to be rather shrouded to you, that you don't quite know who they are and you don't hear them reflect as much about their own life outside of work. Now, that could be for whatever personality reason, but it could also be that they're trying to hide who they are. It's too difficult to try to switch the pronouns about who they took out over the weekend. Or if I say that I went dancing and I had a really fun time, somebody may want to know where I went dancing, and once I tell them it's the name of the local gay bar in town, then the gig's up. So, you know, and I think that shroudedness would be a way to describe, perhaps, what closetedness is about. For some people, it's more thinly veiled, and some people, it's harder to see through it. But part of the reason to ask and to know is, are you a person who could be a support for this individual or for this couple? I mean, who are the people that help celebrate the anniversaries of gay and lesbian couples of long standing? You know, often a pretty small circle of people and not their families. I know too many people at the breakup of a relationship whose own family and parents have said to them, perhaps it's for the best, you know, you and really relate to you better when you're single anyway. It's a painful sort of back and forth. Let's go back here in the center and then Lynn, and back to you again.
Well,
over here too.
You just hit on a chord with me that a breakup in a relationship, even though, you know, they're good and bad homosexual relationships as well as heterosexual relationships.
Uh-huh.
As a parent, you can see the bad parts of the relationship,
right.
not because of the sex of the two people, but because of the personalities sometimes too.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. You had something?
I just know that it was very helpful for me in a conversation with a lesbian friend who just said in a very clear way, the justice issues when you're part of the dominant culture are always around privacy because you have access to your own visibility. But the justice issues when you don't have that access are always around being invisible and having the right to be visible in a culture that is saying we want you to disappear.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than focus on, you know, whether or not somebody needs to or wants to come out of the closet, do they have the ability to do that without paying a price that's so high that it destroys other values in their life?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I will remember the way you've named that. Did you have something?
I was just going to remark, for me this week, it's sort of being attached with Anita. I think people have made assumptions, but
which are okay.
G by A, we were calling that guilt by association.
But it's been really affirming for me in this community to have people acknowledge who I am. We don't even really need to talk that much, but even to talk about Lutheran's concern or being, you know, invited to come stay. Carl and Sue, who took care of me on the boat ride up, invited to me to visit if I'm ever back in Washington, and if Anita wanted to come along too. I mean, that just really... it's very affirming. So, I also had the another little bit in my workplace. Because I was elected president of Lutheran's Concerned, it was appearing in the gay papers around town, which was fun, and it thrilled me when one of my straight coworkers came up to me and said, "Congratulations on your election."
Mm-hmm.
That she had read it in the local paper, and it meant a lot. And I'm out to her at work, and it meant a lot to me that she came up and acknowledged that to me. So there's those caring ways that you can connect with people, but I think it's similar to react to what you're saying. It's similar to asking somebody whether or not they're married. I mean, you just don't do that unless you have some sort of rapport or basis of relationship and respect for the person to ask those kind of personal questions. So,
yes.
I'm really curious, and you work with, or if in conversation with adolescents particularly, it seems sort of like a dichotomy of, I mean, more and more gays and lesbians are coming out. It's becoming slowly more and more accepted that they will be able to come out, or that they do that anyway, whether they like it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like our younger generation, our adolescents particularly, having been growing up in this sort of changing culture, might be more accepting of the fact that there are gays and lesbians in our environment.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I hear a lot of adolescents being very crass with the fags and the this and that. You know, just very much like, don't even let them get near me, and they're such awful people. Just in the tone and in the way they address the topic of conversation. And it seems like such a dichotomy, and yet I wonder if it goes back to that, the 10 or the 8 things you wrote up, where repulsion is one of the first ones, or, you know, first attributes of what we go through to begin to accept, mm-hmm. and tolerate and then support and nurture. And I just wonder, in your observations and working with teenagers, if you see that, you know, a lot, or if that's just sort of this, you know, that I haven't heard very much, or what's happening with adolescents and the whole issue.
I think your observations are right. As I talk with adolescents and with younger children, to our parents more often of younger children in elementary school age, it is the taunts of fag, queer, you know, whatever, that are the current day put-downs that kids use with each other long before they understand what the words mean, or that it has anything to do about one's orientation, one's sexuality, one's relationality. I'm not sure quite how to address that. I think perhaps because it's more open culturally, then they're more fearful that somebody's going to label me that. The stereotypes seem to, you know, lift to the fore very quickly about identifying who is or who isn't. But my experience in working with teenagers is that they, too, are very caring people when they meet somebody, if they have a peer who comes out to them. We have a poster we put together through the ministry Wingspan that I work with last year that is aimed at use in schools, in consultation with a group of people from the St. Paul Public Schools, put together a poster that says, "What do you say when your best friend says I'm gay?" Then it has a series of little cartoons there and little clips underneath it about, you know, don't tell queer jokes anymore. Don't abandon them, stay with them, perhaps help them find somebody, an adult to talk with who's safe about it. One of the reasons that the poster was put together was at the request of school nurses and counselors, school psychologists, others. It's like, how can we let gay teenagers know that we're a safe person to them to come to talk with? And yet it worked out better to have the poster, even to put the shroud of safety that any kid can read the poster, because it says, what does it say if my friend says I am? It doesn't say, if you're gay, you know. But it says, if your friend says they're gay, how do you respond to that? There is a resource available from, there's a journal called Interracial Books for Children, and there was a couple of articles in that, I think maybe 83. You have to go back and look up the specific reference, I don't have it. But there's a lesson plan in there about name calling. It's set for third and fourth graders. It's something that we could use in a Sunday school class. And it includes in there name calling of this sort, as well as having them go through an exercise together where they list all the kinds of things that you call each other. You know, fatty, four eyes, cripple, blah, blah. You know, we could come up with the list. Or perhaps kids could come up with it better. But part of the exercise is that they, in a small group then, you know, sort of a group of three, call the names to each other and write down and think about what it feels like to have that called. And then you help them go through an exercise creatively coming up with, what are some comebacks I can use to take the sting out of this kind of stuff? And you just include the gay or lesbian thing in the midst of that rather than making it some separate section. And there's also an accompanying piece that goes with it called What Do I Say When I Hear Faggot, written by a teacher response. And I think we need to be more creative about how we do that, about how we work with not only adults, but with teenagers and with younger kids, about not having any group that we, as people of faith, feel are disposable to us, that we can sacrifice to the sake of one up, one down. You know, I have to put somebody down to make myself feel good, is not the kind of self-esteem building kinds of stuff that I want to impart to youth in any way. Nor do I think most of us in the church, but we don't end up addressing this topic for fear that if we take the strictures off, the painful result from being gay or lesbian, I think the big fear is that more people are going to be gay. And I don't think that that's in reality. I think that's fear. I think what will happen is that we'll respond differently to that group of people. And that's what kids will learn, is how to respond differently. My family is in the Deep South, in the middle of the Bible Belt. My younger sister, who I'm closest with of my siblings, has three children of her own, lives just outside of Little Rock, Arkansas. And yeah, they have a drawl down there and talk funny. It's really fun. But she, a year ago, when I went back home for my 20-year high school reunion, and I flew in to Little Rock first and visited with my sister, and then drove down to Mississippi where I went to high school. And as I was arriving, she had spent a couple hours that afternoon talking with my 15-year-old nephew about me. She had never talked with him about my being gay. And it was really interesting, his response. He said, you know, I hear a lot of that kind of stuff at school. I've engaged in it myself. I don't quite know what's so scary about it or why we have to jump on people in that way. And it really meant a lot to me, the way in which this young fellow responded.
Hadn't planned that one. The way in which he responded so well to me during that stay, because I didn't know how these kids would be. And there's two more to go. We'll see how they are with it too. But it was really neat, his response. And he hugged me just the same as always. My nickname is Dee Dee in the family. I don't remember even, I think it was my eldest brother who nicknamed me that. But his Aunt Dee Dee, you're just the same as always, and I love you. Kind of response that goes to the core of me and is what unconditional acceptance and love is about. And so to have that modeled to me from a teenager was pretty neat. So you're going to go out from this place. If you do hear comments, with your friends or somebody at work overhear them with their response about an obnoxious comment about gays, what do you do? Talk with each other a bit about what are the range of possibilities.
I guess the first one for me in a lot of situations is just to sort of check that out and respond with, gee, you know, I just really haven't had that experience.
I haven't had that experience.
Yeah. And just sort of leave it as open, but trust in my own instead of what somebody else may be feeding into me.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes I ignore it, sort of turn from it and just or leave.
I often ask the question, what's the issue? Because I'm in a healthcare environment.
Okay.
And in nursing, there are more gay men than the 10%.
Okay.
And so it's an issue that does surface frequently. And so my attitude is that I have to help the person or find out myself, what is the real issue? Is the issue their prejudice or bias, which is often the case?
Mm-hmm.
Or is there another issue that needs to be dealt with? And if the issue is their prejudice or bias, then I don't deal with it.
Yeah.
If it's another issue, then I deal with it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Other ideas about how you might respond?
Well, I was taken back a bit this morning during breakfast when the young man spoke, you know, about not taken back by what he spoke about at
yeah.
all. I thought it was wonderful that he shared that men should hug each other and show concern and love and friendship and
mm-hmm.
become real friends with another man. But after he was through sharing it, I had sat at a table with old children, and the boys at the table asked me, was he gay? And it just sort of you know, took me back. I really thought, I don't even know how to answer them. I mean, I don't know, you know. But, you know, it just took me back that they asked that question.
Okay. In response to that a little bit, I'll share that in my workplace I was confronted with. Well, sure, I'm a Lutheran pastor, and partly because I'm single and 30, that's the assumption. That's the assumption we work with. And because of what finally kicked it over for the people at church was because I got a roommate. Because I didn't get a woman for a roommate. You know, what was that you know, Bill came to live with me. That raised fears, and the church council gathered. You know, and these are folks. They're not, it's folks. It's us. You know, it's the Lutheran church. And it was delightful. At least my response was, I'm not going to tell you. You don't get to know. What finally kind of angered me was when they asked me to change my behavior, to ask me to not to look, to begin to, they didn't get as far because I really got angry before they had the chance to get too specific. But it was like, you know, we don't want you hugging as much. We don't want you to act as loving and caring as you know how to be, because we're afraid other people. No, we trust you, Pastor. We trust you, but what about people who might come to this church? What about people in town? What are they going to think about us as a community? And it's bizarre, because we should be known as, you know, a community who doesn't love and touch and care and hold hands, and you know, how do we want to be known? But that was the issue. Mm-hmm. You know, it's because I've had men stay and I've taken people in, and I was worried about, you know, I wouldn't normally bring a woman into the house for a month or two. but this is an age where homophobia is really strong. And I joked at the beginning of my stay there that I was, yeah, really concerned about having women coming going from the parsonage. Like, that would be the buzz around town, right? Well, right away, it was this, the story started to go, the mouths clacked. And what it was, I joked, it didn't come to that, but what the real concern would be, not that women friends would be coming by, but that my friend Mark would come and stay for the weekend. You know, that was really more of a gut level concern. And then I joked finally that, you know, gosh, and what if Frank came? Frank's a married man. I was like, my God. Pastor's with a married man. But that's the tables are turning, so right. In that way.
That's a real example of the way homophobia affects all of us. Homophobia isn't something that just affects gay and lesbian people. And homophobia has to it an external component in which the other people sort of lay it over everyone, and an internal thing that my own judging about my own behavior here this week, and how is somebody going to view it if I hug somebody, or at the does it make any difference who I danced with last Friday night at the lumberjack ball? You know, I made a point to try to dance equally with as many male and female people who've been coming to my classes all week long, just so that, you know, there wouldn't be that kind of fearfulness on somebody's part about what that was about. And we had a really fun time, but that kind of internal judging my own behavior all the time. I heard Dan Spencer speak about that very clearly and well earlier this week. Yeah, by the window.
Well, I think the church really needs to address the issue of human sexuality. I think a lot of these problems come from our fear of sexuality. We have to categorize people. They have to be either in this group or that group, so we can kind of understand, label them, so we can understand or figure out how we can relate to them. I have a couple really good lesbian friends, and I felt in visiting them and going to parties and dances with them, I felt excluded because I am not gay, and it's like I have been the outsider, and it's like, and they have judged other people who come into the group that they're not dressed right, or they're not walking right, or they're carrying a purse and they're not supposed to be carrying a purse, or that if I was gay, I would be happier. So it's, I felt it both ways. It's like you have to fit this certain mold, and I felt it as a single woman. It's like people can't quite figure out who I am, or, you know, I'm not married and I don't have kids, and so I think it's really broad. It's like we feel more comfortable if we can put people into categories or groups. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I do that too. It's easier to figure out, kind of like, you know, if you're talking to a married man versus a single man, or it's kind of like you know what the rules are. Mm-hmm. And I think it's real scary to throw out all the rules and just start from scratch.
And I think that's well named. But I think there are things that we can learn, too, about from having to, you know, some of the benefits to people who are heterosexual about looking at this topic is to begin to look at gay and lesbian relationships that are healthy relationships, that are long-lasting relationships. And these are people who, in effect, have had to throw out all the rules and start over. It may be a learning place for us as a group to begin to look at intimacy in a different way. And we haven't had that kind of model lifted up to say why. You know, why does this work and why have they held together? The legal strictures are not there to stay together in the same sorts of ways that they are. It's not costly to divorce, you know, et cetera. All those sorts of things are there. But I think my experience of opening this topic at many a congregation is that it opens the door to people to talk about their own sexuality, their own experience of sexuality, both the goodness and the brokenness within it, and that we as a church have been real scared to talk about sexuality at all, to talk about intimacy, to talk about what makes intimacy. Where is it that we help our teenagers learn that intimacy and sex are not the same thing? Where do we help us as adults learn that they're not the same thing? And that we as people have touch needs, and that those touch needs can be met in many kinds of ways, not just in sexual ways. But then the fear about hugging one another or touching one another. And I think we're moving into a real period with fear about sexual abuse in particular, and the fear of lawsuit as a result, that puts us in a difficult place as a Christian community. How do then we respond to one another if I have to be fearful if I hug you? That a lawsuit's coming or an accusation's going to be made. And once the accusations are made about being gay, how do you disprove it? I mean, you know, that has been a way in which in the feminist movement, the women's movement from the 70s through to now, to discount the feminist movement is to make the accusation that they're all a bunch of lesbians. Well, once somebody has made the accusation, for you example, that you must be gay because you've had male friends come and stay at your place, how do you disprove that? Even if you marry, does the question go away for
no,
people?
Yeah. I know how people try, and that's to play up anything heterosexual. But I was sort of relating to because I'm a single pastor.
Uh-huh.
And not only that, but I did my seminary in Berkeley, California, which is dangerously close.
Dangerously close.
but what I found happening is that, and I, by nature, keep my relationships to a minimum, and they are few and far between. And once I got into a dating relationship, I found people playing it up to a point where it became uncomfortable for me. And the one vacation I took to visit an old girlfriend, that got talked about. I noticed to a degree that I sensed people having those fears were trying to relieve them for themselves and for other people. And I felt like saying, do you realize that most of the gay people in this church are married? do you want me to act heterosexual to just like, you know, the person in the pew next to you who may be gay? Do you want me, what does that prove, I guess?
And what does it say about the trust level and our ability to talk about it? Mm-hmm. You know, we never talked about it in the 4.5 years I was there. Mm-hmm. No, it did. When I came, there were little clues that the search committee, who wanted me there as a pastor, tried to send out to the congregation to relieve fear. So there was a talk about it, at least that little bit. But mm-hmm. everything else was all under the surface. Mm-hmm. I felt very uncomfortable about that, but I didn't know what to do.
Well, and I think we support that as a national church. I mean, when seminary students have to sign a document saying you won't have any kind of sexual intimacy if you're single, and that you won't practice anything that's even remotely related to homosexual behavior, in order to be a Lutheran pastor, we are saying to our congregations, we will get you a guarantee you won't have to deal with this issue. You know, we've got it here in writing. I mean, our church structures really need to be addressed at this point. They're the process of the social statements being written now and the sexuality study that's in process. It seems to me that now is really a time when we need to make sure that a lot of different voices get heard in that process, because we've got, I just finished seminary, and when I met with my committee and was asked to agree to a draft document, and I said to them, this is a draft document that no one in the churches, broad-based, have looked at and agreed to. Why are you asking me to agree to live by it for the rest of my life? They said, you have one interview tonight. You either let us leave this interview with a yes, or you're out of the endorsement process. And basically, that's, you know, the manipulation in that as a broad-based system effectively keeps us as a people from having to have that conversation that you are talking about. The irony of that situation for me, though, was that when I said to them, will you define for me what sexual intimacy is so I know for sure what I'm agreeing to? No one in the committee had anything to say. So I said, well, when you let me know what you want me to agree to, I'll do what I can. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The interview was over.
Well, we've come to a time of closing, and I want to say to each of you what a wonderful experience it's been to sit in such a place, to hear people's voices, to hear the stories back.